Our God has life in and of himself, which is to say he is entirely independent. He needs nothing from no one. He needs nothing. I guess I should say he needs nothing from anyone. He has life in and of himself. He created all things, including human beings, who, unlike all other creation, was created in his image. He not only sustains all things in the universe, but he also providentially governs all his creatures and all of their actions, which is to say he rules and reigns over all things as the sovereign and authoritative King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He is eternal, which is to say he has no beginning and he has no end. He is also immutable, which is to say he is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He is the God of grace and mercy and love. He is the God of truth. He is the God of righteousness and wrath and judgment. He is incomprehensible, which is to say he cannot be known in his entirety, not perfectly or exhaustively, by his created beings. As he testifies himself, "My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." Our God is transcendent above all. He is holy, yet he has made himself known by revealing himself to us through creation and through his word and through his Son who condescended to us on that Christmas morning so long ago. God is omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent, which is to say he has all power. He knows all things, and he is not confined by time nor space. Yet, as his word testifies, his special presence, his special residence is in the heavens, and he does whatever he pleases. The Lord our God is one God, yet as our confession explains well, he consists of three persons, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and these three have the same substance, power, and eternity, each having a whole divine essence, without this essence being divided. The covenant name by which God is revealed in the Old Testament is Yahweh, indicated by Lord in all caps in your Bibles, while in the New Testament he's revealed through his Son, Jesus, who is the exact imprint of his nature. He is divine and infinite. He is holy and exalted above all. He will not share his glory with any other, and he is worthy of all worship. Now, in his divine wisdom, he has a plan to save a people for his glory. And these people exist particularly to worship him. And these people will worship him forevermore, which brings us to our text today, which, as I said, is 1 Samuel 2, 11 through 36. Now, when you open the book of Samuel, the first person that you meet is Elkanah. Elkanah was committed to the worship of Yahweh, and he was also committed to the will of Yahweh being accomplished. And we saw this in his regular attendance at Shiloh to offer sacrifices. But we also saw this when he conceded to his wife's wishes concerning going to the temple on a few years. And he adds, as long as God's will is done. Now, speaking of one of Elkanah's wives, while we first were introduced to Elkanah, it becomes very clear that the opening chapters of 1 Samuel chapter 1 anyway, in the first half of chapter 2, we find that the focus is not actually on Elkanah, it is on Hannah. Now, Hannah was a barren woman who had poured out her heart to God, and she was subsequently blessed with a son, which is what she wanted. And she had made a vow to God that if God gave her a son, she would give him back, which she did. As we saw when we left 1 Samuel last week, once Hannah weaned her son, she brought him to the temple in Shiloh. She offered her sacrifices, and then she prayed a wonderful and worshipful prayer to the God who gave her a son. As we pick things up this week, we discovered that after all that, Hannah returned home with Elkanah and the rest of her family, except for her son, who we read in verse 11, was ministering to the Lord in the presence of Eli the priest. Now, Eli was not the only priest in Shiloh. Two of his sons were also priests. if you could call them that. And the author of 1 Samuel actually told us that already. If you look back to 1 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 3, he just kind of mentions the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, who were also priests to the Lord. Now, we don't know really much else about them, except the fact that they've obviously been ministering as priests for a fair amount of time, because they were mentioned back in verse 3, and now here we are a number of years later, at least 4 to 5 years later, and they're mentioned as well. But now, unfortunately, we do learn a fair bit about them, a fair bit that we'd probably care not to know. So I'm going to begin reading in 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verses 12 through 17. It says, "Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord," that's Yahweh. "The custom of the priests with the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand, and he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. This is what they did at Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Moreover, before the fat was burned, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, 'Give meat for the priest to roast, for he will not accept boiled meat from you, but only raw.' And if the man said to him, 'Let them burn the fat first and then take as much as you wish,' he would say, 'No, you must give it now. And if not, I will take it by force.' Thus the sin of the young man was very great in the sight of Yahweh, for the men treated the offering of Yahweh with contempt." Now, there are two things in particular that we learn about Eli's sons here. Two things which tell us why, as Scripture rightly testifies, that they were worthless men. Worthless men. And the first is that they had no concern for God. We read there in verse 12 that they did not know the Lord. Now, understand that this does not mean that they didn't know who God was. And it doesn't mean that they did not know of God. They knew who God was, and they knew God existed, just as every single human being knows that God exists. They just didn't care. Hophni and Phinehas knew God. They just did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Those are the words of the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 1, speaking of those who believe or suggest that God does not exist. Hophni and Phinehas cared about one thing. Hophni and Phinehas. As the CSB translates it, they did not respect the Lord, is what it means there when it says they did not know him. As the NIV translates it, they had no regard for the Lord. And as the NET puts it, they did not recognize the Lord's authority. However you translate it, the bottom line is that they did not care about God. They gave no thought to Yahweh or to his presence with them. God and their responsibility to him and his people was of no concern to them whatsoever. They did not love God. They did not trust God, and they did not seek to honor him in any way, shape, or form, not with their thoughts, not with their words, and not with their actions. Now, because these two men had no concern for God, they likewise had no concern for the worship of God, which is especially wicked, seeing as that they were serving as priests for the people of God. And in case you didn't know, the role of priests was to ensure that God's people worshiped God's ways. It's not that different, you know. Pastors are definitely different than priests, but pastors are responsible to make sure that the people of God worship God God's way. This is why we at this church follow the regulative principle. We want to worship the way that God has indicated that we ought to worship. And I take that seriously as a leader of God's people. Now, these two priests, they didn't care about God, and they didn't care about his worship. And we see this when we consider how they dealt with the sacrifices that the Israelites offered. Now, you need to know that in God's kindness and wisdom, he had provided instructions to ensure that the priests were not for want. I mean, how were the priests supposed to make a living when they were serving in the temple? And so he had provided instructions, we see in Leviticus 2 and Leviticus 10 and Numbers 18 and in other places, where you see that there were portions of the sacrifices that were brought that were set aside for the priests so that they could eat. I mean, they got to eat, right? And so we still see this principle in place today, right? I got to eat, and so you all provide offerings, and I'm provided for. But it's almost like you decided for me what was an appropriate salary, and I said, okay, that's fine, and then you gave me a salary. But then let's just say all the offering got put in that box on Sunday, and on my way out, I would just open the box, and I would just put my hand in, whatever I pulled out, I mean, that would be... That you know, just because I think I deserve some more. That's what was happening here. God had provided instructions for what they should receive, but they were walking out and they were putting their hand in the box, and whatever they brought up, that was for them. When God had clearly laid out what they ought to get. Now, they didn't have an offering box, but they had an offering pot, and the sacrifice would be in the offering pot, and they would send their servant out to wherever somebody was offering their sacrifice, and he would have one of those, you know, those large, like, barbecue forks. It's got, like, three forks on it, right? When you got a really thick steak, and you poke it in, and you turn it over. And they would take one of those forks, and they would just stick it into the pot, and whatever came out, that was for Hophni and Phinehas. And notice there in verse 14, they didn't just do this once in a while. It wasn't just like, you know, every now and then, like every fourth offerer, every fourth worshiper, they would come in. No, it says they did this. They took their extra cut from all the Israelites who came to Shiloh to worship. They clearly did not care about God's instructions. They wanted what they wanted. Their God was their belly, and they gloried in their shame with minds set on earthly things. But it gets worse, because they would demand their cut before the fat had been burnt. And as we all know, the fat is the best part, right? Like, I never understood why people have a nice juicy steak and they leave the fat sitting on the plate. Man, really, the fat, is, the flavor is in the fat. Sorry, I'm getting aside. My cooking is jumping in here, but seriously, the fat is the best part. But that's not what made this significant. It wasn't that the fat was the best part. It was that the fat was supposed to be burnt for the Lord. The fat was to be set aside and burnt for the Lord. There's very clear instructions of this in Leviticus 3:3-5, that when an offering was brought, the fat was to be burnt as a pleasing aroma to Yahweh. You set aside the best part for the Lord. And what they would do is they would demand their cut before the fat was burnt. And if the worshiper said, excuse me, that fat needs to be burnt, They would demand, no, it's not going to be burnt. And if you tried to actually physically stop them, they would physically interject and take out what they wanted. So somebody comes, we really need to grasp the significance of what is going on here. Somebody comes to the temple and they want to worship the way God has demanded that he be worshiped. And the priest said no. And if you tried to fight the priest would literally fight you for the fat. It says, if the man said to him, let them burn the fat first, and then you can take all you want, he would say, no, give it now, and if you don't, I will take it by force. So people want to worship rightly, and the priests are saying no, just so they could get what they wanted. Now, God, of course, was not at all pleased with Hophni and Phinehas. It says, in fact, here that their sin was great because they not only had no concern for worship, but they treated right worship with contempt. They were not ambivalent or laissez-faire when it came to worship. They hated it. So Hophni and Phinehas had no concern for God or for the worship of God. On the other hand, as we read in verse 18, Samuel was ministering before the Lord, before Yahweh, a boy clothed with a linen ephod. Now, if we skip down to verse 22, we get back to Hophni and Phinehas. Now, Eli was very old, and he kept hearing all that his sons were doing to all Israel, and how they lay with the women who were serving at the entrance to the tent of meeting. And he said to them, why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all the people. No, my sons, it is not good report that I hear the people of Yahweh spreading abroad. If someone sins against a man, God will mediate for him. But if someone sins against Yahweh, who can intercede for him? But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of Yahweh to put them to death. So Hophni and Phinehas were bad priests, but Hophni and Phinehas were just bad people. How they treated the sacrifice clearly reveals the sins of greed and gluttony, while now we learn about their sin of lust. We have already seen their lack of concern for the worshipers, but now we see their lack of concern for those who came to serve in the temple, in particular, women. Here were two men who were supposed to lead people to sanctification, and they were instead leading people into sexual immorality. And they weren't the least bit worried about hiding it. They sinned, and they sinned openly, and they didn't care who knew it. I mean, if they were willing to steal from God, and they were willing to sleep with women who served in the temple, it's hard to imagine what they wouldn't do. They obviously had no concern whatsoever for righteousness, no concern for doing good, no concern for morality. Now, there was someone who was concerned about it, at least to some degree, and that would be Eli, their father. You see, not only did everyone know of their wickedness, but many had come to their father who had obviously put them in place as priests and had told them about what they were doing. And while we don't have an exact timeline, it seems pretty clear to me that Eli knew about their wickedness for a good length of time. He definitely knew about it long enough because the text tells us that he kept hearing all that his sons were doing. So he certainly knew about it for a good portion of time. And then he finally speaks to them and he gets to the heart of the matter. He addresses their primary problem, and it is that they're sinning against God. Now, surely we can all acknowledge that they had sinned against the people of God in many ways. I mean, they had literally stopped them from worshiping rightly. We can also see that they sinned against these servants at the temple by leading them into sexual immorality. But it's important that we recognize that before all that, and through all that, and in all that, they had sinned against God. They were at enmity with God. They were in rebellion against God. They had offended God. That was why Eli's sons were worthless, because they were not serving as they were supposed to, and they were not even living how they were supposed to. They were supposed to be godly men who interceded for the people of God, but because of their rebellion against God, there would be no intercession for them. And if they would not turn from their sin, and if they would not throw themselves at the mercy of God, they were sure to face God's wrath for all eternity. And this was Eli's concern. But I don't think any of us are surprised when we consider what we know about Hophni and Phinehas thus far, that they refused to listen to the warnings of their fathers, only adding one more sin to their list of egregious offenses against God: disobedience to parents. So they stopped right worship, they led temple servants into sexual immorality, and now they disobey their parents. Now at this point, I don't know if you noticed this, but we get a peek into the sovereign will of God in our text. In verse 25, look at the end of verse 25. But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of Yahweh to put them to death. They would not listen to the voice of their father because it was the will of Yahweh to put them to death. Their continual rebellion, we see here, was due to God's judgment upon them. He had already judged them. He had already determined to put them to death. We actually find out here that they were not chosen before the foundation of the world to be people of God. We say in the church many times, we don't know those who are elect, which is why we share the gospel with everybody. But we do know here that Hophni and Phinehas were not elect. It was the will of Yahweh to put them to death, which is why they continued on in their rebellion. They hardened their hearts, and God hardened their hearts, just like with the Pharaoh. They would thus face the judgment of God for all eternity. And this is confirmed by an unnamed prophet who comes onto the scene near the end of our text. But before we get to that, I want to remind you of a few things. Number one, God is just and his judgment is just. The God of all the earth will always do what is right. Second of all, Hophni and Phinehas had committed their lives to willful rebellion to the God who created and sustained them and the one who demanded total obedience and submission. They could not claim ignorance, demonstrated by their refusal to heed their father's warnings. Hophni and Phinehas had no concern for righteousness and no desire to please God. On the other hand, as we read in verse 26, now the young man Samuel continued to grow both in stature and in favor with Yahweh and also with men. And there came a man of God to Eli and said to him, thus the Lord, that's Yahweh, has said, did I indeed reveal myself to the house of your father when they were in Egypt, subject to the house of Pharaoh? Did I choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest, to go up to my altar, to burn incense, to wear an ephod before me? I gave to the house of your father all my offerings by fire from the people of Israel. Why then do you scorn my sacrifices and my offerings that I commanded and honor your sons above me by fattening yourselves on the choicest parts of every offering of my people Israel? Remember, he's talking to Eli here. Therefore, the Lord Yahweh, the God of Israel, declares, I promised that your house and the house of your father should go in and out before me forever. But now Yahweh declares, far be it from me, for those who honor me, I will honor, and those who despise me shall be lightly esteemed. Behold, the days are coming when I will cut off your strength and the strength of your father's house, so that there will not be an old man in your house. Then in distress you will look with envious eye on all the prosperity that shall be bestowed on Israel, and there shall not be an old man in your house forever. The only one of you whom I shall not cut off from my altar shall be spared to weep his eyes out, to grieve his heart, and all the descendants of your house shall die by the sword of men. And this that shall come upon your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, shall be the sign to you. Both of them shall die on the same day. And I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind. And I will build him a sure house, and he shall go in and out before my anointed forever. And everyone who is left in your house shall come to implore him for a piece of silver or a loaf of bread and shall say, please put me in one of the priest's places that I may eat a morsel of bread. Now I know that's a long prophecy. There's a lot in that prophecy. I'm not going to go through every detail of that prophecy. I'm just going to summarize and pull out a few things there. The first thing we must deal with, as I mentioned, this is a prophecy about a judgment being pronounced on Eli, on the father of Hophni and Phinehas. Now, there's a few things that we find in this judgment on Eli. The first is that the prophet reminds Eli of what an incredibly gracious thing it was of God to call Eli and his sons to be priests. It was a most gracious gift to be chosen to such an esteemed role among the people of God. We see this in verse 27 and 28. It's clearly something they didn't recognize. He then points out Eli's sins, that he did not take the priestly role in the worship of God seriously enough, and he instead chose to honor his sons rather than to honor God. That, man, that is something you see a lot in this day and age, don't you? I hate to bring this up, but there's just one example that just sticks out so often in this area. So often when you see a pastor crumble on the issue of sexual ethics and begin to become LGBTQ affirming, in no time at all you find out they have a child who is in fact LGBTQ. I've seen that over and over and over again. But in other ways we see this also. Eli's sins was that he did not take the role that God had given him as a leader of God's people seriously enough, and he chose to honor his children over his God. Now finally, because of this, the prophet delivers the judgment for Eli's sins, which though there's more to it, I'm going to summarize. And I spent a lot of time on this. I read a lot of commentaries on this. I wanted to make sure I got this right because there's a lot of historical details in this section here. But let me summarize it. The judgment for Eli's sins is that the torch for priestly service, which had belonged to his family, would be taken from him and passed to another. The torch for priestly service, which had belonged to his family, would be taken from him and passed to another, as is called here, a faithful priest, which is most likely a reference to Zadok. Something else I'm not going to go into here. I'm sure you probably thought it was Samuel, and it certainly applies to Samuel, but there's some details in here that indicate that it more than likely refers to a priest named Zadok. I think at this stage in our walk through the text, the important thing to realize is that Eli is not without sin. I did read a few commentaries that kind of didn't state it outright, but seemed to indicate that, you know, Eli's doing everything right here, but Eli is not doing everything right. He did warn his sons, and he most certainly didn't approve of what they were doing, but he allowed them to keep doing what they were doing. And worse, he even benefited from what they were doing. And there were consequences to Eli's sins, that the gracious gift given to his family would be taken away. The esteemed role that they held would be given to another because Eli did not do what he should have done. The fact of the matter is that he should have done everything he absolutely could do to put an end to his son's abominable temple service. He should have removed them from their roles and put a stop to their wicked abuses of their priestly roles. I don't think it's just a slight detail here that it tells us that Eli was an old man. It's like he was tired. He had had enough, but there was something he needed to do, and he didn't do it. Servants of God were being led into sexual immorality by his sons. Offerings of God's people were being robbed by his sons. Worship was being hindered and treated with contempt by his sons, and all he does is warn them of the judgment to come. Now, it's no small matter to warn them of the judgment to come. But while he couldn't change their wicked hearts, he could put a stop to their wicked deeds as priests of Yahweh, and he didn't. So judgment would come upon him and his line, and the honorable priestly duties would be passed to another. God himself says, "Far be it from me. Those who honor me, I will honor, and those who despise me shall be lightly esteemed," or shall be dishonored. So when God says there, "Far be it from me," he's saying, "Far be it from me to overlook your sins and ignore your sins." Then he says, if you want to be honored by God, you need to honor him. While if you despise God, you'll be disgraced and disdained by him. Now in our text, we have a wonderful example of a family who honors God and is thus honored by God. In verse 19, we read this. "And Samuel's mother used to make for him a little robe and take it to him each year when she went up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. Then Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, 'May Yahweh give you children by this woman for the petition she asked of Yahweh.' So then they would return to their home. Indeed, Yahweh visited Hannah, and she conceived and bore 3 sons and 2 daughters. And the young man Samuel grew in the presence of Yahweh." You got to love that. The little robe. Every year, she would bring the little robe. You know, Hannah certainly couldn't show love for her son in the way that most moms would. She only saw him once a year. But she did what she could. I can only imagine the heart that went into those robes each year and how the robes got just a little bit bigger every year. But always made with love, I'm sure, because Hannah was committed to the worship of God. And she saw her son in that very important role, and she wanted her son to be provided for. And her husband also was very committed to the worship of Yahweh, as we have seen. And because they honored God, God honored them. She gave back her 1 child, and God gave her 5. Now, 5 more, I should say. Now, make no mistake, God did not owe Hannah and Elkanah anything. He did not owe them anything. This is not I give to you and you give to me. This is not tit for tat. No. This is a demonstration of God's amazing grace. They honored God and God honored them. And all those who are God's people will be honored by God. That is not to say they will be healthy, wealthy, and wise. It is to say that they will be honored, and come the last day, they will receive all things. Now, on the flip side, in contrast, we come once again to Eli's worthless sons. They dishonored God and they faced disgrace and disdain. From the mysterious unnamed prophet, we learn that both Hophni and Phinehas are going to die on the same day, which would serve as a confirmation of the prophecy, and they would then face the consequences of their sin and wicked ways forevermore. They gave their lives to the mockery of God, the one who reigns and rules over all, but they would one day learn that God is not mocked. For whatever one sows, that he will also reap. As we will see in a week or two, Hophni and Phinehas would die in battle, but their deaths were not a testimony to the cost and violence of battle. Their deaths were a testimony to the judgment of God. Which brings us to the end of our text, and relatively closer to the end of our sermon than we were when we begun. This sermon in which Hophni and Phinehas are clearly presented as negative examples. If you leave this morning and you aren't thinking that you should not be like Hophni and Phinehas, I have either not done my job or you have not been paying attention. Now, because I take my job seriously, and just in case anyone missed it, I'm going to say it for you just as plainly as I can. Don't be like Hophni and Phinehas. They had no concern for God or for his worship. They had no concern for righteousness or morality. They lived in persistent rebellion against God. They refused to heed their father's warnings to turn from their sin, and they faced the consequences of such, which is judgment from the righteous right hand of God. There can be no doubt that the good majority of the text which we have considered today is bad news. Not an especially fun text to spend 40 or 45 minutes in. Our narrative addresses a very dark and disturbing time in the life of God's people. The state of their worship was abysmal due to Eli's worthless son and Eli's unwillingness to remove them from their priestly role. We clearly see in our text a bad example in both Hophni and Phinehas. But there's something else we shouldn't miss in this text. And I didn't spend hardly any time at all focusing on this because it's something that we see from within this negative example. And it is that God is committed to be worshipped by his people. God is committed to be worshipped by his people. We see this first in the prophecy which closes out our text when God declares that he will put an end to Eli's worthless sons. Right? They were hindering the right worship of God, and God says, I will put an end to them. God would not let their mockery of the priestly service and their contempt for worship go on. And the reason that he would not let that go on, because he was committed to receiving worship from his people. But we also see this in four statements interspersed throughout this dark and disturbing narrative. Yes, the majority of this text focuses on Hophni and Phinehas. But at four very strategic times, we read about someone else through whom God would lead his people to worship him. These are those four statements. In verse 11, we read, and the boy was ministering to Yahweh in the presence of Eli the priest. And then in verse 18, we read, Samuel was ministering before Yahweh, a boy clothed with a linen ephod. And then in verse 21, we read, and the boy Samuel grew in the presence of Yahweh. And then in verse 26, we read, now the boy Samuel continued to grow both in stature and in favor with the Lord and also with man. And then there's one more strategically placed statement, which is going to be a transition to our text for next week, which is at verse 1 of chapter 3, where we read, now the young man Samuel was ministering to Yahweh under Eli, and the word of the Lord was rare in those days. There was no frequent vision. You see, though it was a dark time for the people of God, I mean, imagine coming to worship and the priest stopping you from right worship. It was a dark time. Imagine coming to worship and instead of sanctification in the temple, there was sex. I mean, it was not a happy time. It was dark. It was disturbing, to say the least. Yet in the midst of this dark time for the people of God, and though the worship of God was not what it should have been because of Eli's worthless sons, there was another boy who Eli raised who provides a very stark contrast to his worthless sons. Unlike Hophni and Phinehas, Samuel was concerned about God and his worship. Unlike Hophni and Phinehas, Samuel was concerned about righteousness and what pleased God. And unlike Hophni and Phinehas, Samuel would in fact be honored by God to lead God's people to worship him rightly. And we're going to see that in the weeks to come. You see, God is committed to his people, and he is committed to receiving worship from his people. So while Eli's sons were willfully seeking to hinder the worship of God, God was busy raising up Samuel. And Samuel will be used in great and powerful ways as a prophet and a priest and a judge to lead God's people to worship, because God is worthy of worship. And while we see that in Samuel for a time, and we will see it in other priests to come, there is someone that Samuel's ministry foreshadows, someone who will ensure that God's people will worship God perfectly forevermore, and that is none other than Jesus, the faithful high priest who every other faithful priest pointed forward to. You see, I actually think that we live in a time where in many ways God is not worshipped as he ought to be. But you can rest assured that he will be. And we know this because of Jesus. We know of God's commitment to be worshipped by his people because of what Jesus has done through his perfect life, through his sacrificial death, and through his glorious resurrection. And we also know this because of what Jesus is doing right now as our high priest. He intercedes for us right now. God has not given up on his people, and he has not given up on his commitment to receiving worship from his people. And his people are all those who repent of their sins and trust entirely in Jesus for salvation. And what God has done through Christ and what he is doing teaches us that there is no greater purpose in this life than to worship God. There is no greater purpose in this life than to worship God, whether through sickness or through health, whether with much or with little. In all things, there is nothing, no greater purpose in this life than to worship God through Christ and by his Spirit. And we look forward while we worship God in this life to when Jesus will return to raise his people from the dead to worship him perfectly forevermore in the new heavens and earth.